And welcome to episode 11 of Artist Materialist, The Smell of Old Books. I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer.
I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And today we are discussing the article, What's That Smell You're Reading? Ann Elizabeth Wiener in Science History. And this is an article basically about the science of why old books smell the way they do. And I'm sure anybody who loves books is familiar with opening an old book, maybe from the library, maybe from the house of somebody who collects lots of books, and it has a particular smell. And a lot of people are very fond of old book smell. I've heard some of my friends wax poetic about it. Is that something that you've noticed as well?
I have a memory of a couple of paperbacks in my youth. And other than that, there are specific other books. Of all things, my former advisor, had his book, when new, has a particular smell that was pretty nice. But other than that, I guess I to say about smell generally, but it's this is not one of my particular about yourself.
I actually do really enjoy the old book smell, and I remember going to the library as a kid and looking through the books to find ones that I hadn't read yet, and just picking up ones that had interesting sounding titles. And very often mm-hmm. they would be pretty old, usually from, you know, the 1930s or 40s. Maybe 50s, and they would have that particular smell where you knew that they were old. The pages were not quite white anymore, but they weren't really yellowed. So I guess the old books that I think about are ones that are maybe a few decades old, whereas the author here is writing about ones that are hundreds of years old, and I don't have quite as much experience with those particular books. But I did go, and... because I do have a lot of old books in my house. I went around and smelled some of them just to see what the smells reminded me of.
And did you have any particular reactions to any of them, or they don't have that smell?
Well, some of them do. I think it's the old paperbacks do have that kind of old book smell. I remember, but the one I thought was the most interesting was there is a book of, it's one of those old art books, called Pictures from the Louvre, and it smells like a museum. I can't describe the smell any other way. When I smell it, I think, this smells like an art museum, which is kind of odd. I don't know how they managed that with the book, but it just has that sort of soapy, museum-y smell to it. Maybe it's the color plates that are in the book, the glue used to hold them or something like that. I don't know.
Well, when you sent this article to me, and I want to hear how you found it, the thing that immediately came to mind was some reporting that I'd heard from the science writer Ed Yong, who currently writes at The Atlantic, and he had been reporting on this ongoing studies, and there's some updates that I've seen in a couple of places, including NPR this year. But there's studies that are being done about hunter-gatherers, two specific groups of hunter-gatherers that have they have specific words for smells, but they don't necessarily have a lot of words for colors. And in contrast, most languages on the planet don't have a lot of words for smells. And for instance, there's only three in English. There's only fragrant... There's one other, and then the only true smell word is musky.
I don't know.
Which can apply.
I would have to disagree that there are so few words for smells. And if I can take us off track for just a moment, I won't list them all. But as you may recall, several years ago, I was in a band called Aromatic. And the very first song the band came out with was basically a long list of synonyms for the word aromatic. So I can tell you there are a lot of words. There are a lot of English synonyms for smelly things.
But that just tells you that something that has a smell. It doesn't tell you what that smell
Ah,
is.
okay. Well, I will have to go back and look at the words, the lyrics to that song again, because now I'm wondering exactly what is in there, because I'm sure there are more than three.
The one that really stands out is musty, which can be applied to old books, and it's that smell that's musty. And whereas pretty much every other smell word, you say it smells like bananas or cloves or whatever. It smells like a particular, even a chemical, but there's just that one word that's has that undefined. It's a particular smell.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess there's pungent. You can use that to that.
I think that was the third one.
Okay.
That might have been the third one.
I'm gonna have to think about that. That's very interesting. I'm sure there have to be more, but I guess if they say so, I'm gonna have to hit the thesaurus hard later. That's interesting that they would focus on smell so much. I know that, humans particularly do tend to use our eyes more than our noses, as opposed to, I think you were the one who gave me that book about dogs that examines how dogs work in detail, and dogs really see with their noses more than their eyes. That's how they perceive the world, and they perceive, slight variations in scent and whole scentscapes, and people. It's not that people are incapable of smelling in that much detail, but we generally don't because we have our eyes and our ears and our visual sense is so strong. I can understand why we would have more words for colors than we would for a particular scents.
And that's what this reporting is about. When they studying these particular hunter-gatherer groups, is that it's not necessarily that they can smell any more detailed, but because they grow up having these particular words for particular classes of smell, and it's not that it's just that it's one thing, but all these different things that have a certain smell, like the color blue. All these different things have the color blue. All these things have the same smell, and so they get grouped together in that way. And so you just have the language to describe it.
Okay. So,
So, anyways, coming back to how you came upon this.
again, it was another one that I found through long reads, and I was looking for things that were science related just because I felt like we should do some science stuff before going back to culture again, going back and forth. And because I love books so much, this really appealed to me. I have a lot of books in my house. They're just in every room, there are stacks of books, there are shelves full of books, and old ones, new ones, some from my husband's grandmother when they were cleaning out her house. They asked which books I wanted, and he brought home a whole pile of them, and there's some great stuff in there. So, yes, I definitely love books and have good memories of wandering through libraries and the library smell. I thought that was particularly interesting, where they talk about how they tried to recreate the particular smell of a particular library by capturing the air and then analyzing the volatile organic compounds in the air of the library. And as a material scientist, is that a sort of experiment that you are familiar with?
I haven't. It's not something that I did personally, but it is something that's done a lot. And as it talks about, it's the same thing that you would do if you're a big food company and you're analyzing the smell of food or what even the taste of food. It's the same thing that you do. If you're trying to identify impurities in some sort of chemical product, maybe you're doing pharmaceutical synthesis. It's the same thing that you do if you're one of the people who's studying why wine tastes the way it does. It's all the same analysis, generally a gas chromatograph, and there's been a lot of advances in that. And you basically take you start off with something that will evaporate, so it'll volatilize. So they're already just taking that part, and you have it you can analyze the size of the molecules, and you can do certain things to measure what the charge is, and that tells you what molecules there are, what atoms there are other than carbon and hydrogen, so that you can get a sense of the charge. And there's various things you can do, and that can use all sorts of calculations, and you can really identify which particular molecules are there, especially if they're not too big.
Fascinating that they're able to do that. And you mentioned the similarities between testing VOCs to determine a particular smell or to identify a particular smell, and also using the same process to identify a particular taste or flavor, correct?
Right.
And now I'm
Yeah.
wondering what the library of St. Paul's Cathedral would taste like. What an old book tastes like. I mean, it's sort of the same contents. Probably wouldn't taste as good as it smells, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think that falls under that category.
That's very interesting. So, in the article, they discuss how they recreated the smell of this library and also recreated the smell of a particular old book and asked people to describe it. And that made me wonder what particular smells I've smelled where it just took me back to a particular time and place, and I smelled something and I said, oh, that reminds me of, like, for example, when I smelled this book of photos from the Louvre or paintings from the Louvre, I smelled it and I said, wow, that smells like a museum. Something about that combination of compounds made me think museum. And so, what are there any particular smells that sort of do that to you, take you to a particular place?
Oh, constantly. For just almost every day, if it's warm enough, just the smell of warm asphalt places me back to waiting to be picked up from karate class next to warm asphalt. It's just a constant reminder. There's all sorts of smell memories like that. They can be very strong.
There are some for me too. I know that the smell of warm grass makes me think of the hiking trail up to Girl Scout camp, things like that. And the smell of dried beer on wood floors takes me back to college. I know that's a terrible smell, but it's kind of nostalgic for me.
Well, it's particular, and yeah, one of the things that I was sort of surprised at, and I wasn't, m m maybe if you maybe when you read it, you got it a little bit more closely. About half the article is talks about all the different kinds of things that eat books, and I wasn't quite sure what that was doing. I wasn't quite sure how that tied in with the smell portion, but that was. It really struck me how they make note of Aristotle talking about the things that ate books, or the things that ate the parchment of the day. And you're thinking that evolution happens on evolutionary time scales, and back in the time of Aristotle, I don't think there had been the written word had been around all that long.
No, I like Hooke's description of the bookworms as the teeth of time destroying the books. And I guess looking back over the article, I guess the connection here is talking about decay and how book decay is what really it's decay that creates those smells because the compounds that the book is made of are decaying. And depending on whether it's a modern book, a very, very old book, made from parchment or vellum, and depending on what the inks and the binding are made of, it will decay in a particular way. And the creatures that eat the books are part of that decay. Although I have to say, again, I haven't found bookworms, or I guess biscuit beetles and woodworms and all the different kinds of book-eating insects. I haven't really had a problem with them just because I think the books I have maybe aren't old enough or I haven't stored them poorly enough.
You're fortunate. I've encountered a number of these critters.
Oh no. Where is the
Silverfish for sure. Silverfish, cleaning up the grandparents out the grandparents' effects, and the mice had certainly nested in letters.
Oh, that's right. You were that was in that old basement where I'm sure there was a lot of decay and stuff in that old
Well,
basement.
there were active mice.
Oh no.
Active baby mice. That was pretty gross.
Oh goodness.
And I just encountered a couple of carpet beetles just this last weekend, but those were on clothes. But fortunately, there were just a couple of them, and I guess they apparently they eat just about anything.
Yeah, I do remember encountering silverfish in the attic. I guess they were usually eating the cardboard boxes that things were stored in, I noticed, or just stacks of paper, like, old tax returns or whatever that were stored in file boxes. I have not come across them much in books, but I'm sure there's plenty of time for that to happen. Which is amazing, considering I live somewhere that right now that is just, bugs are everywhere, all the time, and that there would be a particular kind of bug that is leaving us alone kind of boggles my mind, to be honest. Maybe all the other bugs have run them away. We have so many spiders that the bookworms don't want to bother with us.
Well, and I wonder, certainly one thing that drives bugs inside is either that it's really wet or it's really dry outside. And maybe the bookworms are more, they get driven inside maybe when it's really dry rather than when it's really wet. I don't,
That could be.
just pure speculation.
I also do not have any books of vellum, so at least that I know of. I do have one really old copy of the Door Bible Gallery, which is a really cool looking old book that it's basically a set of engravings from stories in the Bible, and that's one of the books from the grandma's house that I wanted to keep just because it's a really cool old book and it looks like something that would be part of a movie about a mysterious old book or something like that.
Well, talking about the decay causing the smells, I think it was sort of instructive that when they for that that it would be the paperbacks that would have a particular smell, because the whole point of them is that they're not made with particular care, and to the extent that there's I can't necessarily tell the difference. If you handed me this paper and that paper, I might be able to say that one paper is more expensive than the other, but what exactly that is probably has a lot to do with whether or not it's going to decay. And the cheap paper and the cheap books are more likely to be the ones that decay, and so they'll smell sooner.
Even within paperbacks, there's a huge amount of difference. And again, that's something that I do notice is when I get a new book, is I pay a lot of attention to, the quality of the paper and the thickness of the paper and the quality of the printing and all that, just because that's kind of what I do by instinct now. And I do remember talking about book smells. There was one cop I bought some copies of Mad Libs for the kids. Just some new ones, and they were smelled so bad. I don't know if it was the ink or the paper, but they were, it's just Mad Libs. It was really cheap ink and paper, and it smelled so bad the kids didn't want to have anything to do with them until they, I guess, whatever VOCs were causing those smells had dissipated enough that they didn't stink anymore. I do have some very old paperbacks from the 70s. Okay, I guess that's not very old, but that's pretty old. And they're actually in decent condition. So it's possible to make paperbacks that last. And I know there's some too that are the trade paperbacks that are the ones that are put out when books are new and they're newly come to paperback. And those do tend to be on cheaper paper. And I don't know how well my trade paperbacks are going to last, because I do have some of those that I want to keep for a long time. We'll see if they survive.
There's a lot of technology that goes into certainly the inks. And I can imagine it's not something that I've looked into over what has been used over the course of time, but can imagine that there was a some glue that was used a long, long time ago, and then at some point for a while they were using the new synthetic glue that seemed real, like a great idea, but it turned out that maybe it melted the people who, you know, it caused horrible cancer things to the people who handled it, or maybe it didn't last very long, but it was really cheap at the time, or some sort of thing like that, and then having getting replaced with something newer. And so there might be, and that's, I think that one of the things they talk about is in identifying these old books is really seeing what the particular things are made out of. Or it might have been just this week there was a report on getting tape off of old artwork and how conservators have to identify exactly which one of 150 different kinds of tape was used because they're trying to remove it, but it seemed like a great idea at the time to use it to put a pencil sketch into a frame. Oh, we'll just tape it in. It's this miracle stuff. And then 60 years later, like, no, you've ruined it.
Yes. That's something that bothers me is when I do have an old book and I come across where somebody has taped pages together with, you know, just plain old cellophane tape, and it's yellowed and destroyed the page and eaten it away with acid and everything. That's we've gotten a lot wiser about using, you know, acid-free adhesives and all of the things that the scrapbooking crowd is very careful with. There was something that the author mentioned towards the end of this article that I thought was odd, and I would like to hear your opinion on it. In the last paragraph, she's talking about how wonderful physical books are, as you know, as she says, in the age of e-books and tablets, the idiosyncrasies of a printed book are erased. But you know, she's talking about how transporting and sharing and keeping books is nice to do with a physical book, and I don't disagree with how convenient physical books are. I just disagree with her idea that it's easy to keep electronic books without decay, because I have the problem of when the Nooks came out, the e-paper, the Nooks with e-paper, I got one, and mine has since broken, and I haven't been able to power it back up again. No matter how much I plug it in and mash the button and restart it, I cannot get it to turn back on. And so essentially, all the books that are on there are lost. I mean, they're gone. They don't exist. They're in this little black box that, and they're untouchable. And there's also the question of formats. I mean, if these are in EPUB format, you know, 100 years from now, are we going to be able to decipher that format? Are we going to be able to read PDFs 100 years from now? Formatting matters, and I think that actually, for purposes of storage and archival, physical books are superior to electronic books because you just have to open it up to be able to read it. You don't have to try and figure out how it was put together and do some sort of forensic technology wizardry to get a hold of it.
I mean, certainly you can think of there's a lot of wizardry that has gone into trying to read burnt books or books that have been through a fire but aren't completely gone, but they've kind of singed together. And there's all sorts of fancy X-ray technology that they use to try to, you know, basically X-ray vision through the books and try to see the pigment. So you can read bits of it. And so that's something that's, you know, you go through a lot of effort to read things.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. It brings to mind another word,
And
that palimpsest. That's where they talk about the when they used old vellum and they would scrape it off to write something new. If you with modern techniques, we can see the original words that were on the paper. So I guess there is some detective work that sometimes has to go into reading really old books.
Well, and also, I mean, it's you have to know the language, which is a lot like knowing the format, the file format, right? You just need to know what language it's in. So now, certainly, I agree that with a physical book, the volumetric compression is much lower. So you have each symbol is much larger, and so it has a lot more, you have to get rid of a lot more atoms, and a lot more degradation has to happen before you can't read it anymore. Whereas with a solid state drive, you know, a couple of atoms here and there, and the information is truly gone.
There's a book by Alistair Reynolds called Century Rain, where it talks about something that happened called the nanocost, where basically all electronic records got destroyed because of some virus. So far in the future, everything from basically the mid 21st century on, for like the next 50 to 100 years, I can't remember exactly, was destroyed. And so they basically lost that entire chunk of history unless it was non-electronic. And that was, I think about that book a lot when I think about how much we depend these days on electronic records for everything, for our photographs, our books, every kind of file. And I do it too, because I don't want piles of paper everywhere, even though I have them. And it just shows that, you know, there's some value to keeping physical copies of things. You never know what, I mean, obviously they can be destroyed by fire. You don't want another Library of Alexandria to happen, but maybe it's good to keep things in more than one place and more than one format.
And certainly maybe in a while we'll be talking about, then there's the smell of old electronics.
That's true. There is. There absolutely is the smell of old electronics. I mean, you know, my 1990 vintage Mac parts, which I'm sure I know I still have, they do have their own particular smell. And that's the, I'm sure it's the VOCs and the plastics that are degrading.
You've been listening to Artist Materialist. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts or visit our blog at artistmaterialist.wordpress.com.